This is Melissa, December 15, 2024, and I hope that everyone is doing all right. Hanging in there, maybe even getting a little bit of the joy of the season, the reason for the season. I was just thinking about Alan's work style. And when I first got to Canada, he was doing the RBN talks 3 nights a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And he spent an enormous amount of time of every day keeping up with the news. If he was doing some project in the house, he always had shortwave or some other streaming thing on that he was taking in information. And he did a lot of scouring for news stories. And when that year that I was first there, at the very end of that year, he moved to 5 nights a week at RBN. So Monday through Friday for an hour each evening. And that increased the amount of time that he spent online looking at news stories and researching and considering the topics of the day and how they fit in with the agenda. And when he went to 1 night a week on the blurbs Sunday night, he maintained a pretty faithful daily schedule of listening to news, looking, reading, finding out what was going on in the world. But on that last day before he recorded, so pretty much all Saturday, he'd really get into looking at all the different major news aggregators or sites and listening to things. And sometimes he'd be, you know, right up to in the evening before he'd sit down to record, even late at night. And one time we were talking about this, I just said, I don't know what I asked him about it. And he said, well, what if somebody sets off a nuclear bomb and World War III starts? You know, so it was kind of a joke, but, you know, he said, I'd look like a, you know, like I wasn't keeping up if I didn't know what was going on in the world. It's kind of funny to think about that, you know. So a nuclear bomb is set off and World War III has started, and everybody's not worried about that, but the, you know, oh, hey, look at Alan, he missed that. But that is what happened to me last week when I was recording the talk late on Saturday afternoon into the evening, and then I did the video, and I hadn't been following the news very faithfully during the week, and so that was Saturday, just running around doing whatever personal thing I was doing and then sitting down to record and make a video. And then that took me up till late Saturday night, and I got up the next morning and uploaded it to the sites and did all the checking and turned it into an audio and et cetera, et cetera. And finally, when I was done with all that, I said, well, I better check the email and the news that I follow, the Substacks and whatever, because I haven't checked my email in 24 hours. I haven't looked at any news, and oh my goodness, what happened? Oh, what happened in Syria? Oh, how did I miss that? So then I really understood Alan's, you know, I've got to just write to the last minute before I sit down in front of the mic, find out what's going on in the world, what are people talking about, etc. So what I did on Monday morning was I gave a call to Brandon Turbeville and recorded about, I don't know, 25 minutes, half an hour with Brandon. He is a journalist, and he has covered Syria extensively. He's actually traveled there several times and really knows the situation pretty well, is certainly better than anyone I know. And longtime listeners will remember that Brandon is someone that Alan actually spoke with, you know, off air quite a bit. But I know of at least one or maybe two kind of interview things that he did with Brandon. And I have done a real history with him in the, I think it was like late summer of last year, 2023. We've also linked to his articles, quite a few times. So I knew that if someone was going to, tell me what just happened in Syria and what it means, an analysis, it would be Brandon. So for this Redux, what I'm going to do is just play a smallish portion of a talk that Alan did back in 2019, October 20. And I've actually used this in its entirety for a Redux that was Redux number 32. And today we're on Redux number 191. So that's a long time ago, October 31, 2021. And Alan's, this is right before the election too, in 2020, the big presidential U.S. presidential election, about 2 weeks prior to that. So the title and little two-line poem is "Vote for dot 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 question mark question mark question mark question mark." We're on par with China using techniques coercive, total surveillance on all in the great collective. So that tells you what this is about. This is surveillance. Everywhere you go, the big eye that's watching you. And I'm not sure how much of this I will use. It is a good talk, and I encourage you to check it out. I'll supply the link to the entire audio for you. And I don't think I'll check right now if there's a transcript for this one up. But if there is, I will link to that as well. So it's Alan's not really deeply covering the Syria situation, but he makes a comment there, and I think it's worth hearing. And I'll just give you a little bit of this following the conversation that I had with Brandon Turbeville. So it will be a different kind of Redux this week. And I wanted to let you know that because of your emotional and support, I am feeling better than I did last week, definitely. I was so discouraged, and I just really felt like it was going to be impossible to keep going in the way that I do. And I really appreciate everyone who's gotten in touch and people who have donated or said that they were going to donate. There's been a good letting me know that what I'm doing is helpful to you and it's important and that you want me to keep going. And I got a couple of orders. I had mentioned the German translation of Waiting for the Miracle. And I said that I had transcribed that book, and it's really the transcript form of the Ancient Religions, Ancient History CDs that are available for sale on the website. And also what those were was the talks that Alan did with Jackie Petru. There are a lot of talks with Jackie on the website, but not those that make up that book. And they're interesting. I think it's good to have it in book form, I think, because it's just an excellent reference. You can see dates and names and places that are referenced. And so that book has been available in Spanish and Portuguese translations. Of course, it's available in English, but I'm really excited because G und G, the nomadic gardeners from Germany, this was their labor of love, and they did a great job. Well, I don't speak German, but I trust they did a great job. It looks good, and I was so thrilled to make copies of those and punch holes in them and put the little binding rings in them and then take them to the mailbox and send them out on Thursday. That was really great. And also on Thursday morning, the flash drives did arrive to me, and I had been just, biting my fingernails because of little production issues that delayed their production and getting to me. But if you ordered them, they are on the way to you. And I'm hoping, it's my goal to run out because that would help me keep a roof over my head. But much more important than that is that these seven flash drives, they do not include Alan's books, but this is so much, that's such a big part of his life's work right here. The talks that he has done in audio form, the videos that he has done, and they're beautifully packaged, and I feel so good about being able to contribute this to Alan's amazing legacy. He was one of a kind, we all know that, and his words, I believe, are more important now than they've ever been. And so, again, thank you for letting me know that you want me to hang in there and that you are going to try to help me. And I just feel more optimistic, I guess. I have a better outlook for the future that this is doable. I'll be able to think of ways to keep going. So, that is my update with things, and I hope that you enjoy this talk, Redux number 191, where there's a conversation with Brandon Turbeville about what just happened in Syria. Keep in mind, this was recorded on Monday, and I am not going to supply any more verbal analysis of the situation. I will supply some news links so that you can see the latest at, my time Saturday night of what is going on with that situation and a few other things to highlight for you news-wise. Have a great week. Take care, and I will be back next week. I am on with Brandon Turbeville. And you, longtime listeners and readers and visitors to the website, will know that Alan Watt linked to journalistic articles that Brandon wrote numerous times over the years. Alan linked to him, and I have as well. I also did a real history with Brandon last year, a little over a year ago, and he has been to Syria a few times. He has been following this situation in Syria for many years. And so when Assad, so-called stepped down and went to Russia, I checked in with Brandon. So thank you for, I know you're a little under the weather, so thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
Well, thanks for reaching out to me. It's an important topic, and it's an unfortunate tragedy that just happened a couple of days ago.
So we
But
are,
I guess
go ahead.
I start off by saying I guess this is something that if people are familiar with my work, they kind of know what transpired. But for those that don't, essentially, Syria is now under the control, the entire country is now under control of ISIS, of Al-Nusra Front, Al-Qaeda, under the name of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. But it's just a name change from Al-Nusra Front, Jabhat al-Nusra, and all the related groups. They keep changing their names. And this happened in a matter of 3 days. This was not something that, we've watched this battle be undertaken for 13 years. These terrorists have attempted to overthrow the Syrian government with the backing of the United States. Actually, not just the backing. They were organized, funded, and trained by the United States, Turkey, Israel, and NATO for the purpose of overthrowing the Syrian government. And for 13 years, the Syrian government fought them off valiantly. But all of a sudden, last week, it was 3 days, they left from Idlib, took over Aleppo, then hit Hama, Homs, Dara, Damascus. I'm seeing reports that they had taken Damascus in 60 seconds. There was essentially no resistance whatsoever from the Syrians, the Syrian military, from the Russian military, from the Iranian forces, from Hezbollah forces, from Iraqi forces. There was no resistance at all. And to me, this is clearly indicative of some type of deal that was made internationally. Mm-hmm. Just the fact that Assad fled the country and headed to Moscow, that's not something that's done on a whim. You can't, right. If you're the president of Syria, you can't just hop on a plane, go to Moscow and say, I'm staying here now and I have diplomatic protection. That's something that's negotiated and agreed to by Russia. Mm-hmm. So they knew, and this was done, I can't imagine this was done in 3 days. There was never any real resistance put up, even when they attacked Aleppo. The Syrian military simply backed out of Aleppo. Now, the military was told to stand down. They didn't run away. They were ordered to stand down by, presumably, the Assad government. We also have Hezbollah and Iranian forces just scurrying out of the area ahead of this. As the new front was launched, they just left immediately. The Russians launched a few bombs toward Idlib, and then within a matter of hours, that had been stopped also. So that tells me that was probably a miscommunication with the Russian forces that didn't get the memo that everybody was supposed to stand down. Mm-hmm. But again, there has to be a deal here that was made. The Iranians backed down, the Syrians backed down, the Russians backed down, all at the same time. So this looks to me like this has been negotiated in secret for, I would say, a matter of at least several weeks. My big question is, what was Russia offered that was able to convince them to agree to abandoning Assad? And what was Iran offered? What were they shown that would prevent them from turning the deal down? What was the option on the table? So there's a lot of questions here. We likely won't ever know officially what the deal was, but we can read between the lines as the days move forward. We can look and see what's happening and kind of tell.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say I did not announce the date that we are recording, but this is Monday, the 9th of December, and I mentioned to you when I gave you a ring this morning that I had done the intro for the Redux last Saturday afternoon, and I was working on the video, and I had a couple of personal things to do, and I didn't look at mail for over 24 hours. And after I posted everywhere, I'm like, oh, look at that. How I just completely missed it from even the 3-day lead up to it. But looking at it, there are several things that come to mind. The first is that you've got this ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah. The timing of that is now very interesting. And one report that I read this morning said that Turkish forces had fired on U.S.-backed militia. So I'm not sure what that means. But it's making me think. Now, I don't know what Iran's, like you said, we won't know what they negotiated, what they gave up, what they got. But we've got to think that Iran is still, you know, it's on the list.
It really, if you look at the big losers in this deal, whatever it is, Syria obviously is the biggest loser, but out of the countries that have survived, Iran is the biggest loser, because what happens when Syria falls or has fallen, the land bridge that Iran has to Hezbollah and Lebanon is severed. Mm-hmm. That's called the Shiite Crescent. It goes from Iran through Iraq through Syria into Lebanon. That's how they arm and fund Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. And it's always been called the Shiite Crescent. Israel has complained about it. The Gulf Cooperation countries have complained about it. They want to break that Shiite Crescent. And that's what they've done. So there's really no way, no practical way, for Iran to continue supporting and funding Hezbollah at this point. With Lebanon in shambles, the Israeli military pretty much has that country sewed in. The Israeli Navy is going to be able to protect it from the coast, and there's not really many ways that they can get equipment and funding to Hezbollah at this point. So they essentially lose their forces in Lebanon. The forces had to pull out of Syria, so they lose them there. They have a few forces that are left in Iraq, which are constantly going tit for tat with American soldiers and bases there. But for the most part, Iran has lost a lot of, in my opinion, regional influence. Also makes them look weak. So
one of the images that I saw coming out of this was the ransacked Iranian embassy in Syria that seemed to be featured, you know, it was definitely front page news in the New York Times, which is, you know, supposedly the main, the prestigious U.S. paper. So it's, that's what we're supposed to see, is Iran is humiliated by this.
And I don't see how Iran comes out of this in better shape than it was in 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. I don't see it. That was why my question was, what was Iran offered? Mm-hmm. And was it a carrot or a stick? And just to step back 1 second, you mentioned the Turkish forces. Those are the Turkish-backed terrorists who are attacking the American-backed Kurds mm-hmm. in northeastern. That's another conflict that is going to take place, because the Kurds are destabilizing to Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. And so we're going to have a situation where either Syria is ruled with an iron fist by outright terrorists, or we're going to have a civil war similar to the Lebanese civil war, where you just have a multitude of groups killing each other and civilians being caught in the mix and forming their own militias, and the war continues. So mm-hmm. we're in a situation where that could happen. But I did see that Russia is supposedly keeping its bases in Tartus. And I haven't seen an official Russian statement on that. But as we speak, Israel is bombing the remnants of the Syrian military all over the country. They're bombing tankers. They're bombing the Air Force. They're bombing military infrastructure from the southern part of Syria all the way to Latakia. It's really an unprecedented aerial attack. They're completely destroying the ability for anyone to have a formal, effective military in Syria. So now you have, whoever gains control has no air force. They have no military infrastructure. They have just what the terrorists have in Damascus, AK-47s and some Toyotas that they've outfitted to fit their purposes. And whatever we've given them over for the Syrian government. The tanks are essentially gone. The refueling trucks are gone, too. So this is actually happening right this minute. By the time people hear it, it will be old news. But it's the conflict is still going on.
The one thing, too, that I want to point out that people will have gotten a lot of this week is the rebels are good. These are terrorists. You've just pointed that out. They're terrorists. And the main propaganda papers in the U.S. are presenting this as now that Assad is out, people are going to have to step in and hold him accountable for all of the abuses that he's done to his own people. So it's almost looking like, a Gaddafi kind of setup where you vilify this man. I mean, he's been vilified for years and years, and it's been pointed out to me by a few people that whatever he did, whatever you think about him, he has managed to protect Christians in his country.
Yeah, exactly. This is he protected all of the religious factions in Syria. And Jalani, who is the leader of Ayatollah al-Sham, is stating publicly that he wants the Syria that is for everybody, that everybody has equal rights, and that women won't be forced to wear a veil, that Christians will be protected, that everybody has the equal right to work, etc. Okay, that's good, that's fine. Hope he sticks to it. But I know what that group has done in the 13 years that I watched them progress through Syria, and their related groups that go through Christian villages and literally slaughter all of the people there, through Shiite areas, through moderate Sunnis, and slaughter them and force women to wear the veil, to destroy historical architecture because it's a graven image. I don't think that a three-day ironic road to Damascus trip has convinced Jalani suddenly to be a moderate and a freedom fighter. Mm-hmm. Don't believe it. Mm-hmm. So perhaps he was just an agent all along who wanted to seize power and establish his own rule. But he's going to rule over a country that has no military. He's going to rule over people who've suffered under sanctions for years, who are literally starving, at 1 hour of electricity a day. And I don't see how this doesn't turn into a massive civil war. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the news reports who are painting these guys as freedom fighters and armed groups, that's the term that they're using now, protesters and armed groups. In fact, I will mention, too, that's another sign that some kind of deal had been made, because if you look at it, I was watching an interview with Sergey Lavrov, with Tucker Carlson, as the Aleppo situation was taking place. And Carlson asked him, what do you plan to do about Aleppo? And Lavrov's answer was essentially, well, we have a conference planned in 2025 where we're all going to get together and discuss a political solution. That was a lot different than what Russia was saying just 6 weeks prior. I also noticed that when Aleppo was taken over, Iran's official statement was Syria needs to plead its case to the United Nations. Again, a lot different than the religious fervor with which Iranian leaders were speaking about foreign terrorists in Syria prior to that. So the sudden language change tells you a lot, too. But to get back to what you were saying about the media reports, I sat and watched some of the mainstream reports, BBC and Channel 4, and I saw Jalani giving a speech from the Umayyad Mosque, and they're presenting this guy as if he's finally overthrown the brutal dictator. He's this valiant freedom fighter. He's an actual member of Al-Qaeda. They even admitted it in the program, where they said that Hayatullah al-Sham used to be called Al-Nusra Front, which is Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. And we're presenting this guy as a freedom fighter all over the world. And I don't think people understand how big of a deal that is. Oh, Syria is now the largest terrorist-controlled nation on the face of the earth.
And it has been helped into that position by Israel, by the U.S. I mean, and even Lavrov seems to say different things depending on who he's talking to, because I read that he said to a reporter from Al Jazeera, he got actually kind of angry talking to him and said, stop calling these rebels the opposition. They are terrorists. But he wasn't saying that to Tucker Carlson.
Not at all. I noticed it immediately when he said, "We're going to have a conference. We're going to have a conference with armed groups for that are literally overthrowing the second largest city right now." Didn't make any sense. Israel has had a huge part in it. Now they're taking credit. Netanyahu's taking credit because of the war that they've launched on Hezbollah in Lebanon, that has, by all accounts, Hezbollah is losing miserably. There was the assassination of Nasrallah, and then they had the pager attack, which, I'm no fan of the Israeli government, but you have to admit that was a stunning act of intelligence gathering and sabotage to kill that many people, the leaders of your opposition at one time. And it absolutely decapitated Hezbollah in Lebanon. And so they're taking credit for that. A lot of the Hezbollah fighters that were in Syria had to be repositioned into Lebanon to back them up. But it didn't seem to make any difference. So Israel's taking credit for a lot of that. There is some truth to it. But there's also truth that Israel's been supporting these terrorists the entire time. In fact, there's video of Jalani and other terrorists. There's video of Western-backed terrorists. I'm not going to say Jalani. I'm not clear on that. But thanking the Israelis for their assistance and saying they want a friendly relationship with Israel and they welcome Israeli investment into Syria. Israel's already invaded the Golan Heights, the buffer zone, the UN buffer zone that's in between the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights and the Syrian territory. So they, not only are they bombing the infrastructure, they're also gathering up more territory for themselves. But essentially, what people have to understand, too, is that because Syria is now the largest terrorist-controlled nation, that's something that's going to have to be dealt with at some point. And the outgoing administration seems determined to booby-trap the entire world for the incoming administration, whether it's long-range missiles going into Moscow or toward Moscow, or it's the destruction of Syria. It's a powder keg, and we've even got Lindsey Graham now essentially arguing for some type of military action in Syria already. It hasn't even stopped smoking there yet, and he's already calling for this stuff. So it's not going to go gentle into that good night in the next couple of weeks and then fade from the news. It will come back in the news, I would say, in the next year. I don't see how it couldn't.
Well, it also, I mean, this is harsh, but it sets up long-term goals. It puts them on the chessboard and makes it ready, and there are a lot of people saying, why would the outgoing administration do this to Trump, et cetera? Well, if you take the long term, they're just setting it up for what happens next. And the objective, I can never figure out what we're doing with Russia, but the objective with Iran is to cripple them entirely in the area. And this sets that up beautifully.
Iran is completely isolated at this point. I really don't understand, unless they're so weak that they're just pulling back to their own territory. I don't understand what Iran would get out of making this deal. But they're the next on the chopping block. They've been wanting to go after Iran for a long time, and that will probably be the next Asian or Middle Eastern confrontation, if not Taiwan. That's another thing to watch soon, too, is that Taiwan is a potential powder keg for the next administration. We still have another month and a half before it officially changes those things are very easily, the plugs are very easily pulled.
Well, you had mentioned to me,
possible benefits, and I'm not saying this is good in any way, but the sanctions on Syria have so drastically reduced the living standards of the Syrian people that to the point where they have 1 hour of electricity a day, if that much, and they eat every other day. It's destroyed that country as much as the war did. Now that we have the actual terrorists in charge of the country, it's possible that the United States will lift the sanctions. Ironic, but at least there might be the possibility to send some kind of relief or for them to be able to get more medical supplies and food and whatever else they need into the country, possibly, if they're not slaughtered beforehand.
Yeah. Well, that was just what I was going to ask you about next, because we discussed that briefly when I called you this morning. So it will definitely be double-edged, but if they can have electricity more than 1 hour a day, if they can get some medical supplies and food relief, that will be great. You know, I still remember how you spoke about the humanity of the Syrian people, the intelligence, the dignity, everything, the hospitality that they extended to you, an American, even though they know that our government has been responsible for the horrible situation that they're in. You spoke so appreciatively of their humanity.
It really is. Out of all the places that I've been, it's one of the most striking in terms of the people themselves. And part of that might be what you see in a person in moments of intense stress and desperation. If a person can still show goodness in the face of that, then they're definitely something to be admired. And I really feel for all of them there. And I have contacts there, and nobody knows what's going to happen to them. Civilians, whether they supported Assad or whether they were indifferent and just wanted it to be over, because there is a lot of that. There's a lot of people that just aren't happy that their government's been overthrown, but they're happy that it's over. It's almost like losing a relative that's been suffering under a long illness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want them to go, but there's a certain amount of relief when it's pain is over. And I think there are a lot of them that are just anxious, but, you know, hoping that things will somehow get better, like they've been hoping for the last 13 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, Brandon, I said that I would not keep you too long. Maybe we'll have a chance to check back in and share some more information before the end of the year even.
Yeah, sounds good. I should be available for that. So
okay.
Hopefully I'll be able to talk a little longer next time.
Okay. Well, I am going to try to find articles that you've written in the past that might help shed some light on it. And I will also just revisit the real history, because you pointed out at that time some good backgrounder articles. And you also said that just a couple of days ago, you wrote an article about what should happen. And it's a moot point now, but I'll share that anyway.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm looking forward to speaking to you again.
All right, Brandon. Take care. Thank you so much.
Hi, folks. I'm Alan Watt, and this is Cutting Through the Matrix on the 20th of October, 2019. It's hard to look at news today and accept it as actual fact of any kind, in a way, because everything's presented in a certain way. In the way, of course, it doesn't matter what you look at or what side of things, there's always sides presented to you to choose from. But they eventually merge into the same dialogue pretty well on any particular topic. And it's been that way for an awful long time. And when it merges together, you're left thinking, oh, well. And that oh, well, you see, is the proof that you've just been given an opinion. And it might not be the true opinion, but you won't know at the time. You just go along with it. Oh, okay, that's the opinion of experts. And here we are then. Even when you could disregard what you've just read or been told on television, if you watch television, because your own life's experiences living through the same events are completely different. It really is astonishing how we're managed so perfectly well today. I was thinking too about, say, Britain at one time. It was much easier to control the people by leaking the only kind of news that you wanted them to read. So they gave you a left and a right wing. And of course, that's a trick again, all down through the ages, in a sense, to get people to motivate in a dialectic technique for change, planned change. The people who are the recipients and who will actually make the changes have no idea that's what it's about. They take sides and they're immediately kind of militarized into a cause because of it. They believe it. It never dawns on them that you question everything. And I mean everything by everybody. Really. Because it's so important to question everything. There's no one that's infallible here from being conned. No one at all. It's such a perfect system. But years and years ago, say, up until World War II, it was much easier to at least give the average citizen of any class a particular type of belief in the nation they were born in, even if a lot of it was kind of bogus or rewritten many times, of course, by conquerors, etc. And nations could at the same time paint themselves with glowing colours because they're so wonderfully good to everybody, even when sometimes they went across the planet and pillaged resources. It didn't matter because the average person thinks that's the way it's always been. I mean, they wouldn't feel guilty about it because most of the people didn't profit from it at all. In fact, they paid the bills for it all. It costs a lot of money to go across the planet, supplying armies and transport of all kinds to get resources moved around. And you're given a kind of fictitious history. As I've mentioned so many times, it's astonishing to go across the world and you'll see pipe bands, like Scottish pipe bands, played in parts of the US or in Canada, and even in the police bands and things like that, as a kind of remnant of this, the beginnings in Commonwealth countries, for instance, of the British system. And yet the pipe bands really were created after Culloden, when the Highland Scots, a lot of the Highland Scots, not all of them naturally, have fought against the British forces, they call it, even though a lot of the forces were Southern Scots regiments, to support Prince Charles. Prince Charles was the young pretender sort of thing, as they called it, because against the takeover of the British crown by William. So it's rather astonishing to see this ingrained partial truth and a lot of mythology too, because as I say, the Scottish bands as such, like big bands, didn't exist until after that battle, really. They had a few of them for the regiments they created for England, and after Culloden, it was all the regiments played them in the Scottish regiments. Scotland was a recruiting ground for soldiers, for shock troops. That's what it was for. But the average Scot didn't know that either, and didn't give them the 20th century that they felt proud of these soldiers, even though they had nothing to do with it. You understand? These soldiers of the 20th century were fighting other wars, and in the 1800s too, they've been fighting wars across the world for England. I guess the anger, whatever it was, and the terrible slaughter of Highlanders from Culloden was gradually forced out of the history books for a long time. And the clearing, it wasn't just clearing, it was genocide to an extent too for a lot of people, and men, women and children. That's the truth of it. And they were forbidden to wear tartan, their clan tartans, the local tartans, that was just local really, and or even speak Gaelic for quite a long time. And if they were found doing any of that, they were hung immediately without trial, that was it, by the occupation troops. But no time at all, they could recruit all the different young guys that were left and make them proud of it and give them, allowed them to wear a tartan, as long as it was a regimental tartan for the British Army. And that's how the regiments were really formed. And they could speak Gaelic initially too, in those regiments, so they could do both, wear tartan and their tartan and speak their language. So history has a way of altering everything, and even making people proud of the service to this United Kingdom idea that really didn't flow very well at the time leading up to Culloden. And no one trusted London. It wasn't English, it was London. The people, they knew that London was like a breed of people who controlled incredible finances across the whole planet based in London, still is today. Very old families. And London was a city state set up for collecting taxes from all imports and exports. No ship could come up the Thames without paying duties to the City of London. And that's why the bridges eventually were created that were, they would go up and allow the ships to pass through. You couldn't pass through until you paid the tax. So over time, folk forget all that and are given a different version of history, of a kind of a benevolent type of mastership over the people. And you accept that. And the higher the schools you go to, the more it's fed to you that you're now joining the ranks of the better type, you see. And that works up wonders with a lot of people. And from those people, they select the future politicians and people who are willing to compromise with the big world agenda, the big goal. But history, as I say, demands of you your own history, your own time period, demands of you that you forget everything you've witnessed yourself. Don't believe your lying eyes. Here's the version you're supposed to accept, even with 9/11. When they kept replaying and replaying on television the collapse of buildings into their own footprint, which can only be done with demolition charges, strategically placed, perfectly placed actually. And the buildings, of course, they've never answered why those buildings were supposed to be bomb-proofed. It's astonishing, really, isn't it? It really is astonishing. And there's a lot more to it than that, too. I won't go into it again. I did it ad nauseum a long time ago. But we're told to forget reality and to accept their reality, even though it's kind of distant, like a myth. And that becomes the truth. The myth becomes the truth. You're told to accept it, that this is the version you're supposed to accept, you see. Because out of the event, regardless of who causes it, comes the aftermath. And out of the aftermath becomes it's actually the continuation of a plan to go across the entire Middle East, you know. I mean, most folk don't know, for instance, as I said before, in other talks, that Syria was scheduled for demolishing back in the 1980s, for those who don't know, by the CIA. And it can take time, but they're very patient, the world masters and the revolutionaries, because there's a world revolution going on all the time. And it's not necessarily by those at the bottom who've got placards and so on in the streets. No, it's way above that, way at the very, it's opposite end of the spectrum, in fact, what you're living through and those who govern you are part of the revolutionary movement. The people that you elect are not the bosses, but they certainly do know that, to do what they're told by those who really suffer them. I don't mean by that the population. The population, as I've said many times before, would have no option if they understood truth. And this is why they gave you democracy and voting, that you're getting plundered and used and abused in a very more a sophisticated form of slavery. That's the term that's used. That's what Charles Galton Darwin called it in The Next Million Years, his book, non-fiction book. And Charles Galton Darwin, a member of the Darwin family, was a physicist. And in the 1950s, he wrote his book on how the world was. And a few simple little lines here and there, they let so much out of the bag. But he said that the wild men control the planet. The wild men are those who haven't been tamed by their indoctrination. They've been given a different understanding of reality from childhood in certain families. And they know how the world really works and how the human mind really works and how the populations come to their conclusions. They understand that. They're taught that from an early, early age. They're wild men. And being wild men and not hampered by any cultural norms or even religions that hamper overt nasty action against the populace, they can do whatever they want. There's something awfully important to understand here about what I'm saying. The wild men, you're getting presented what they're trying to tell you are wild men, and they present them as geniuses to you, but they're not, they're front people too. With big bucks behind them, all right. But you're supposed to follow them because you're taught that they're superior to you and they're more intelligent than you are. And they're not bound by conventional laws and norms and so on. And you're supposed to accept that too. Whatever their unconventional behavior is, that's normal too. That must be good now, you see. That's how and people do. They follow these people like they're icons because they're presented as icons. Look at the newspapers. Who they give you to follow. Oh, these super geniuses, they say. And folk, oh, well, I guess they are. No, they're not. They're really not. But that's the whole thing. The wild men of Charles Galton Darwin. Unhampered by conventional norms. Now, you got to understand that your conventional norms in a lot of countries, and in the West, it used to be from Christianity. That was your norm, which gave value to human life, even though they broke it many times, went off to war and killed other human life. They still had that basic understanding for peace within their own borders to make things work. And it kept folk from simply killing each other, because you put a lot of folk together as neighbours without law, and you watch what happens when one tries to widen his garden into the next neighbour's lot by a little bit. You know what happens, don't you? But under a common culture that was supposed to be meant to tolerate each other, at the very least tolerate each other, and to help each other, that didn't bode well with those wild men, you see, because wild men want to break those rules. In fact, if you followed your old ways, you would have disdain for these characters. In fact, you would see through them and who's behind them, too. You would understand that. Because in the religion that you're given, or at least the culture that you came from, which was definitely Christian culture, there's no bones about it, no one was higher than God. And that's something you never forgot. And so you didn't go worshipping people. That was the message there. Don't go worshipping people. And don't emulate them just because they're rich or presented to you as famous or whatever it happens to be. Well, look what happened. The whole war was on, and it was definitely a cultural war. And there's no conspiracy about it. It's admitted to today. It was admitted to us as well by some of the groups involved. They wrote books about it, what they were doing and why they were doing it. No conspiracy. and with understanding of human beings and behavior and social norms, how we change social norms and get different values to substitute them and so on, and a mass media all working together with about 20 different heads with of huge corporations, it's quite easy to do. And today, it's overwhelmingly easy to do in an electronic age. As I say, up until World War II, it was fairly easy with a limited number of newspapers in every country to control thought and give opinions. And there was still a problem back then with old books being around. Old books that could get turned up, which would negate the recent reinterpretation of history and give you a lot of facts that happened in the history that's now been thrown out the window. And today, literally with a digital age, you're watching history disappear, what's left of it, or being completely reinterpreted. Why would you have to have more and more scholars today, say from in London and Oxford, different places, coming on the BBC with their own TV shows on how it was, with new interpretations of how it was, when the closer you got to how it was before, surely it's a more truthful account of what happened. The further you get away from the event and so many changes of reinterpretations, then you've got a completely bogus account of the past in modern times. Because everything today is incredibly hyper-politicized. Viciously so at times. And when I say vicious, I really mean it, because you're now into a socialist type of governmental system. Now, socialism sounds good to a lot of people. Well, it's really to forget the old, what you were taught before, of what you've always been taught. Well, it's, you get something back from your taxes and to help the poor. You have to go way beyond that to understand what socialism is. It's everything run by science, not a deity that gives you rights, but science, which labels you, quantifies you, stamps you, good, bad, in between, whatever. Good citizen, bad citizen, yada yada. For a system that's a collectivist system run by very rich people above it at the top, by the way, which will manage your life from birth to death. So the idea, you understand, even the poorest folk at one time could live in hell in times of terrible deprivation. And countries like Britain and so on, but they still helped each other out because they didn't have the social work departments back then. They didn't have welfare handouts and so on. And they really did depend on each other. They help each other out at times. So friendships were far, far thicker back then to help each other out. Now, when government comes in, there's always a catch, and government will come in and take over your life. We'll help you here, but you've got to comply with this, you see. And it's regimented. Then you're told what to do and where you must go, etc., etc., etc. And they're degrading means tests. That's what they used to call it, means tests, to before they'd help you out at all. So socialism, remember, is part of a revolutionary strategy. And under the guise of socialism, or apparent socialism, because many of them, again, are fronts for much bigger operations, like communism. And I've said it before, that the Council on Foreign Relations, many of its members have written about it, how they had no problems with communism at all. Carl Quigley said that. And he also talked about the ruling groups that studied intensely and intently communism and how it worked on the masses in the Soviet Union and other Soviet bloc countries. And they studied the Nazi organization in Germany, it was National Socialism, intently too, because they thought that, you know, whatever they learn on how to control the masses, which motivates the masses to follow and behave and do what they're told, is important to totalitarian regimes of which are still to come, which we're in today. And true enough, the big banks that run it all, you know, the big system, put it that way, of the World Bank and the IMF and the Bank for International Settlements and your big central banks are all one collective, privately owned. Don't think they're run by the they're owned by the government or the people. And you can't get shares in them. Yeah. That's all spoken for by unknown people. These are the ones who want and demand through this international revolutionary force that's been going on for centuries. They demand that it runs the world. And they decide the state of the economy in every country and the level of living in every country. They can bring it down so quickly, as we're watching today with devaluation of currencies globally from a central command. And through different guises, such as sustainability. And they've already taught, like Bezmenov, Yuri Bezmenov, who said it takes 15 years at least to get a country ready for a step into deeper socialism or dash communism. You can call it what you want, but it's all the same technique, a collectivist system where you just obey authorities. And we've already had all that. We've been through it all. We've been through the 15 years to 20 years long ago. And over another 15, 20 years long ago too, watching world revolution continue under the guise of NATO, by the way. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization. That's had troops from France and Britain and the States and a few other countries in Europe fighting in the Middle East on and off for years and years now. It's a good part of most folks' lives now. And this is for the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It was set up to fight the Soviet or keep the Soviet system at bay up until Margaret Thatcher's time. That's what that was supposed to be about. But we've watched it being used like a massive army, a smash and grab army, going into other countries as they loot oil fields and give it to private corporations and so on. We've watched that. We're still watching it happen. And as I say, 1980s, they had maps drawn out. And I saw the maps too, much later ones too, with when they wanted to go through the whole Gulf there. The first time, and they had big plans for big corporations and nationally orchestrated plans to implement huge gas and oil pipelines going all the way from Bulgaria up through different countries and passing through three or four countries across the Middle East. You know? And you think it's just suddenly happening because a bad man got into power somewhere. Oh, No. Nothing's ever like that. There's always some kind of lame excuse given for wars. But there's always the group behind things which will benefit from them with the collusion of governments on top. And Tony Blair, as I mentioned before, who represented supposedly, he's the far, and Quigley was quite right, eventually all parties are doing the same thing. They'll all promise the same things, election, education's work, and so on, you know. Until there's no difference in reality, except the colours they wear for ties or something. Because there's a world revolutionary movement, and the ones at the top are already picked to front for them, these revolutionary movements. They're not leaders of them. So the wild men, way, way above it, that Charles Galton Darwin talked about, he says, we must stay in control. And they admired the Soviet system and the Nazi system because everybody obeyed the leaders, you see. And they would deprive themselves of all the goodies for all the right reasons, you see, but for the good of the country. So you go, I heard someone in the Green Party say the same thing in Britain years ago. She admired the Blitz and the war, World War II, where everybody had to live on meager rations and without complaining, and they were in starvation rations for a lot of folk. For years. And she said that was wonderful because everybody obeyed the authorities and did what they were told. And that's exactly why the wild men at the top, they're on all, want to bring in the same system under sustainability for the planet. Now, again, back to Charles Galton Darwin, he said that slavery has always existed on Earth in one form or another. And I suppose it always will. It's astonishing. And Aldous Huxley had similar things to say too, of dominant minorities running the show, a dominant minority at the top, a scientific group beneath them, running all the show for those who are at the top, the dominant minority, you know. But anyway, you have slavery in one form or another. And it can be so cleverly disguised you don't know that you are a slave. I don't think people realize that even in the poorest countries, even in the lower classes of some countries, if you went back 50, 60, 70 years ago and made them live under what's coming down now, where you're spied upon by your own governments and farmed out agencies and even private corporations given authority to over all the citizens, spy and watch them, and there's cameras everywhere, and everything, every word you utter has been recorded, and every email you sent or text or whatever has been recorded forever and ever, eh?
A little change of plans here as I'm editing along on a Saturday night, and time is passing, but I got to this point and I was reminded of a talk that Alan gave also in 2019, November 17. A free society is a nuisance to rulers, megalomaniacal. Expect intolerant authority, for efficiency, tyrannical. And I've also used this one as a redux. Redux number 28, October 3, 2021. So a while ago. But Alan mentions Syria in this. What I'm going to do is play a little bit of the beginning, because he goes into the psychopaths at the top. And then I'm going to cut to the end of this, and he'll touch on Syria, and then that will be it. And I don't think that I have transcripts available on either one of these, but I will give you links for the full audios. So thank you, and that's it. I promise I'm not going to add anything else on, just a few minutes of this talk from November 17, and that's it.
I'm Alan Water, and this is Cutting Through the Matrix on the 17th of November, 2019. Last night, Saturday night, the temperature dropped down to about, minus 16 degrees or so Fahrenheit. That's about minus 25, 26 centigrade. It's been cold, really cold days and nights here now for the last week or two, and of course dumps of snow as well in between. And it really does make you consider all the nonsense that you're fed on a daily basis by those that manage your minds. And the incredible lengths they'll go to, which really would make you lose all faith in humanity, with these liars that come out and tell us what to be terrified of and why we should be terrified and how you've got to give up all your rights to save us all and hand over to these self-elected scientists, the new social scientists, of course, that manage the whole system on behalf of their masters. It really is. I mean, I can remember, for instance, basically, the tail end of the coming ice age, that was all the propaganda in the 60s. And that didn't work out. And then they tried the ozone hole, you know, a hole in the ozone with your aerosol sprays and things, and that fizzled off and died away as well. Then they had acid rain as well, another big acid. All the lakes were just dying, they were dead, sterile lakes. And they showed you all these documentaries that showed you flat lakes, you know, it's just very mirror-type lakes on a nice day, and they said they were dead. And if you were young, you'd believe that, because why would adults lie to you? The saddest thing is the lie that your whole life long. And even when you're getting rather old, you're still listening to these supposed adults and experts come out to terrify you on why you've got to give up all your rights. And this silly idea of having freedoms and things like that, it's an awful nuisance to those that want to manage you. It really is. Because they have to go delicately and hire big propaganda outfits and marketers to persuade you. You know, the art of persuasion. And rephrase things in such a way that you'll come round to their way of thinking by being terrified of disobeying them, basically. It never ends, doesn't it? And I gave talks many years ago on how we're controlled and how we're raised, actually, to be controlled. And we're kept in a state of naivete by believing in a system. I mean, look at Al Gore. Al Gore was at 2010 or 12 or whatever, and he came out on his big push. And when he was doing his big round of the world to terrify us with his inconvenient truth, that was more like an inconvenient lack of proof. Proof didn't matter. See, fear dispels any idea of thinking through things logically and getting evidence. It's not meant to do that. It's meant to make you terrified and, you know, just quiver, basically. And obey. That's a very big, disobey until you're told, and then you might get saved. But Gore said, he said, as I'm sitting here up here, in what should have been the Northern Riviera of the Northern Hemisphere, and the land should be worth a fortune because of it, but it's not, because it's still as frozen as ever, and very short summers, and deep, deep snows like last year was incredible right into this year, actually, early this year in the spring. Spring, I never had a spring, you know. The only spring I could do was springing up on top of the roof to shovel off the snow every day. But I can remember Al Gore saying that the children will never see snow again. Back then he said that. And he said, I'll never see it. And you'll be trying to explain to them what snow was. And they'll look at you and they're all bewildered, trying to imagine what this strange substance would be that you were trying to explain to them used to exist. Aye, aye, aye. Well, I tell you, I could make a fortune just doing, getting tours. You can bring them all up here and I'll show them first time. Put a shovel in their hands and get them shoveling. And then they'll know what snow is. But it doesn't stop them. That's what you learn about the psychopathic cliques and so on. There's no shame involved. See, they can only get away with it because most folk out there are decent people. And these folk aren't. They pretend they're you, like chameleons. They come in and pretend they are you, in fact. They even have little shows. They can emulate people. It's like an alien movie, one of these alien movies where they watch and study you. That's what psychopaths do. And they'll see you reacting to tragedy, for instance, or deaths in a family, or deaths of pets, something. And they'll put on a show, because they can watch people grieving. They'll put on a show of grieving. But they can give it away, too, that they really don't feel it by laughing. It's like Bill Clinton at one time laughed at a funeral. He was telling jokes at a funeral a few years back, and it was in the newspapers at the time. You see, things that are inappropriate to normal folk don't affect them because they don't have the same feelings. They don't feel these things. It just isn't there. So they always put on an act to convince the public. Sometimes they're awfully good and they can be pretty successful psychopaths. You had the same kind of abnormal reaction with Hillary Clinton when she made her famous statement about the death of Gaddafi, who literally was tortured with bayonets being put up his rectum and cut apart and disemboweled. And she said, where she wrote this herself, or it was written for her, but she said quite gleefully, very gleefully in fact, a lot of cackling and so on, that we came, we saw, and he died. Ha, ha, ha. And then she went into this strange cacophony of cackling.
So, I mean, that is the land of unconfirmed.
Yes, we came, we saw, he died.
Did it have anything to do with your visit?
No, I'm sure it did.
Dara was tremendously funny. Now, you got to think about what we're talking about here. Anybody who saw that, what happened, were horrified anyway. And it doesn't matter which enemy you have. And don't forget that Gaddafi really was led up the garden path to his extinction eventually. And everybody owed him money, even some people who ran for presidents over in Europe owed him money. Gaddafi helped him to fund him getting in. And he basically funneled, you're talking about real socialism, you know, the kind that's supposed to be based on. So much money was fed back into the people from the oil fields in Libya that they had to import labor from outside countries. And the money was pumped back in. Everybody had free education. And everybody could go to university, all paid for their residencies. Everything was paid for them until they were finished and qualified. And young couples all were guaranteed a place to live that would be theirs, of course, at the state. Healthcare, the whole lot. And they had no debt, you see. There's no debt in the country. They weren't signed on to the World Bank and taking loans out from the World Bank and the various con groups that run the rest of the world. And that couldn't be allowed to happen. But getting back to how he died, even hardened troops, this is the thing, after the facts of being involved in battles and so on, the mature type, they don't look back and laugh at this kind of thing. Because dying is a somber business, and so is killing, remember. It's supposed to be that way. If you start to enjoy it, you've got a problem. And folk who do enjoy it and laugh at it and can see and think it's so hilariously funny, having people disemboweled to basically rule over you, I think you should all be kind of worried. I don't care what country you're in, it's all the same thing. Tony Blair was no different in Britain. None at all. He never saw a profitable war that he didn't like, you know. And he was like a one-man band to get Britain into it. But again, he was owned by foreign interests too. We were living in amazing times when this kind of thing's in your face. And I think part of the problem is the folk don't recognize what we're actually seeing and hearing, because we've been so swamped and drowned in entertainment and raised by it. And violence that's an entertainment, it really doesn't compute with people. It really doesn't. At one time, the show that was put on for the public by politicians had to be the show of respectability. That was what they had to portray and project to the public. Respectable. And respectable people had to have an aura that was projected. Whether it was real or not, it didn't matter, as long as it was projected to the public, of a certain level of standards in different areas. That they couldn't go over a certain line. If they did, they'd suffer, and they'd often step down through embarrassment and shame, because the party was an important thing at one time. And don't forget, the whole point of ruling the public is to keep them believing that they're free. So if you see the scams that go on, you can't believe it anymore, that you actually have rights and so on, especially since 9/11, we've lost them all pretty well across the world. Rather amazing that a couple of terrorists get supposedly hit by terrorists, and it's still debatable who did it, but the whole world has to lose its rights and freedoms because of it. It's just astonishing how folk fall for this kind of thing and allow it to happen, again, in a time of managed crisis. And I remember the time when it happened too. I think it was Alan Hart, it was one of the CFR members, made a statement who says, we can't let this crisis go to waste, you see. We can use it for our plan. What plan is this? Well, it's a plan that you're not in on. And it's a plan for the global structured system, the global management system. That was always the plan of the CFR and their parent group, the Royal Institute for International Affairs. And we're really pretty well there, you know, for the folk who haven't figured it out. But getting back to the psychopaths, it's astonishing how blatant. Today, nothing's shameful, apparently. And as I say, Hillary expected you to applaud her when she came out with her little clever little quip, you see. Very clever, she thought, I guess. I don't know if folk laughed hysterically because they were terrified that they actually heard a person laughing at it in the first place. It was a leader, or it was a shock, a laugh, or what. But the fact is, we saw it, and there's no stepping down or saying there's something wrong here, or this is not the impression to give up the public that you want to preside over. It's all been washed away, and it's brushed under the carpet as though it never happened, but it did happen. And killing people is not something you laugh at, even if that is your profession in the military. If you just make a big standing joke of it all, you have a problem and you got to be watched and kicked out probably, because it's a dangerous, dangerous thing to do. Another article I want to touch on too is OIR, is Operation Inherent Resolve, which is the code name they use behind which the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS cloaks its military activities. This is CJTFOIR as the Combined Joint Task Force for Operation Inherent Resolve. It says, if, as per the spokesman's statement, the forces being redeployed to Syria's oil-producing areas are Inherent Resolve forces, this is about taking Syria's oil, keeping it, it follows that those troops are doing so in the name and under the aegis of the coalition. Simple, but yes, awkward for the British government to admit, awkward for practical, political and legal reasons. In practice, if this is a joint task force operation, as we're told by the US spokesman, it would be next impossible for deployment in Deir ez-Zor province to be taking place without some input from the senior UK officers embedded with the US military in the coalition joint task force headquarters. The deputy commander is a British general and active carrying out Operation Inherent Resolve. Well, the article really goes through the fact that they're just stealing Syria's oil. I mean, of course they are. And they're using other front groups to steal it before now, but now they're going to build bases, a couple of bases, I think, around the area for the US, using troops that they brought in from Iraq, from the bases in Iraq. They've got quite a few there too. And they'll keep taking the oil instead of giving it back to Syria. That's part of its... They own it. The Syrians own it, you know. But like everybody else that owns things these days, you always think you do and you find out eventually you don't. If somebody else wants it. The big powerful beings indeed. And really that's as far as I've got, I think, here. Because this hour just flowing in as usual. I'll put some articles up and links to the articles on all these smart poles that are going up everywhere for the 5G. And I love how they just announce it and they don't ask your opinions on anything. They just announce that they're doing it all. Thousands and thousands of them. Where all the I know the poles have been used before, like electric poles and so on down highways, etc. But they're going to put them all through the cities. And they've got cameras on them too. We've had that for years. But now they're going to use them all for smart poles to 5G base stations and all the rest of it. Just wonderful. If we get fried, our brains will get fried. Or those stroker brains like Technotronics, like Brzezinski talked about, how they could alter our behaviour. And that's how it works. It's almost like stroking your brain, and they can make you angry or sad or depressed or whatever they want, according to the frequencies they'll use on you. Wonderful future, isn't it, for this managed society? And rather than just trying to persuade you to do things or threaten you to do things, they can actually make you do things and behave in certain ways, and it's much more efficient. Well, for myself, Alan Watt, from a very frozen Ontario, Canada, because of global warming, it's good night. May your God or your gods go with you.